Welcome to Defenders, the teaching class of Dr. William Lane Craig. Today, The Doctrine of God, Part 15. For more information and resources, go to reasonablefaith.org.
Well, we want to come to our lesson now today, and I thought we'd begin by way of review so that we're all on the same page. We've been talking about divine omniscience. If anybody needs an outline, we've got outlines and you can raise your hand. We've been talking about the issue of theological fatalism, whether or not everything happens necessarily because God foreknows everything that will happen. If God foreknows everything that's going to happen, then how can there be free will? How can you refrain from doing anything if God already knows you're going to do it? And you remember, fatalism is the view that everything that happens, happens necessarily. That's what fatalism is. Everything that happens, happens necessarily. Theological fatalism is the view that because God foreknows everything, everything happens necessarily. And the argument for theological fatalism goes like this, and we've got a slide this week to show this. The argument for theological fatalism says, let X be any event that you choose, arbitrarily, any event. Necessarily, if God foreknows that X will happen, then X will happen. That's in virtue of what knowledge is. Knowledge is justified true belief. It is what is true. So if God knows that X will happen, then X will happen. Two, God foreknows that X will happen, and it's said to follow from that, therefore, necessarily, X will happen. And therefore, X cannot be free. Everything that happens, happens necessarily. Now, that's the argument for theological fatalism. And what I pointed out last week is that this argument is logically invalid. That is to say, it breaks the rules of logic. All that follows from the two premises is three star, therefore X will happen, but not that necessarily X will happen. From the fact that God foreknows X will happen, you can be sure X will happen, but it doesn't follow that it will happen necessarily. It could fail to happen, but it won't. If it were to fail to happen, then God wouldn't have foreknown X. So you remember I said that God's foreknowledge of the future is very much like a time machine. How many of you have seen the time travel movie Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure? Okay, a few of you have. This is my favorite time travel movie. In it, Bill and Ted have this time traveling device that enables them to go back into the past. And while they're back in the past, they get thrown into jail. And they say to each other, how are we going to get out? We're locked in. How are we going to get out of jail? And one of them suddenly has an idea. He says, I know, we'll come back from the future and we'll leave the keys here so that we can open the cell and get out. And the other one says, great idea, where would we put them? And the other fellow says, there, under the wastebasket. And so they go over and they look under the wastebasket, and sure enough, there are the keys where they've left them returning from the future. Now, from the fact that they find the keys under the wastebasket, you know that they will go back in time and leave them there, right? From the fact that the keys are there, you know they will go back and leave them there. But does that mean that they will necessarily go back and leave it there? No. They could fail to go back and leave them there. But if they were to fail to go back, then the keys wouldn't have been there to be found. They wouldn't have found the keys. So from the fact that the keys are under the wastebasket, you know they will go back in time and leave them there. But it doesn't mean that they don't do so freely. They could still freely refrain, but if they were to refrain, then the keys wouldn't have been there when they looked. So that's an illustration that I hope will convey to you this idea that we have the power to do X or not X. And just whichever one we do, God will foreknow. But his foreknowing it doesn't determine it or doesn't render it necessary. Now, by way of review then, is there any final question about theological fatalism?
I believe I asked you this question 2 weeks ago, and you said it was going to be like a good segue into the next week's thing. And I wasn't here last week, so I wasn't sure if you addressed this or not. But so it seems like that would be compatible only on a B theory of time. That was the question I had. Since it seems like if God is to know what's going to happen, then there sort of needs to be a fatalistic chain of events of cause and effect, so he knows exactly if he causes this, everything in the future is going to play out on an A theory of time, since the present's only as it is now. It seems like to know something is going to happen in the future, and you're saying because we've done it, that's how he knows it, that would have to be a B theory of time.
I think what you're asking, Jonathan, is a quite different question than what we're addressing now. You're asking the question, how can God foreknow the future if these events aren't causally determined by events in the present? And that's a subsequent question that we can take up in a minute. What we're asking here is simply, if he knows them, does that make everything fated to occur? And I think you can see that that doesn't follow. So let's hold off that question about how he foreknows the future. In fact, what I'm going to say later might have some implications for that. Ted?
Just a short question. In number three, therefore necessarily, is necessarily the word that you're tying to God causes? All right, because if you took the word necessarily out, if you could say therefore X will happen, that would be a true statement, would it not, based on the first two, if the word necessarily were not in there?
That's three star down at the bottom. Necessarily X will happen. If you remove the necessarily, that is true. That does follow from one and two.
That's fine.
But don't think the necessarily here is a causal necessity. Remember, I said a week ago, that's the crazy thing about fatalism, is the fatalism isn't saying everything is causally determined to happen. It posits a constraint upon human freedom, which is completely unintelligible, because it says X could be an uncaused event, totally indeterminate, and yet somehow it's constrained to happen just by God knowing it, which is unintelligible. So the argument has got to be fallacious because, as I said, fatalism posits a constraint on human freedom, which is just completely unintelligible.
It gives us a good excuse, though, is when we do some of the stupid things we do.
Right. You can say it's the will of Allah or something like that, but the argument won't work. All right. Let me take one more question on this, and then I want to move ahead. Any other question on this point? Yes, way in the back there.
My question is about human freedom. The reformers would say that we're free to do whatever we want. We only want to do what's bad. And so when God changes our heart, that is the cause of us doing anything good.
Yes, this is different from that, again, in that, as I said, I think a week ago, Luther did believe that in virtue of God's foreknowing the future, everything was fated to occur. But that's not what Calvin thought. Calvin didn't think that just in virtue of God's knowing about the future, everything was fated to occur. So even if you believe that man is sinful and fallen and cannot do any good work, still, I think we would say he has a variety of sins to choose among. He can choose various sins, and so if X is some sinful act, we're not asserting that we have the capacity to do some good, but you could have a choice of sins you might commit. So I don't think, again, that's really at the heart of the issue. The heart of the issue here is whether, in virtue of knowing about something, that thing happens necessarily. In virtue of God's knowing about it.
I'm wondering if that is the issue. The issue to me is if God causes good to happen.
If he what?
God causes good to happen.
Right, and that's not the subject here. As I said, causal constraints are not the issue here. That will come up when we talk about providence, about God's sovereignty. This is just an argument about God's knowing about it. Now, you could say, I don't think, in fact, this is Calvin's position. Calvin's position is that in virtue of God's knowing about it in advance, things aren't necessitated to happen. But he did think that in virtue of God's sovereignty and providence, God caused everything to happen. So Calvin is not a fatalist, but I think he is a determinist. You see the difference? He's a causal determinist, believes everything is caused to happen. And I do think you're right that Calvin thought that. But Calvin wasn't a fatalist. He didn't think that in virtue of God's knowing about the future, everything was fated to happen.
Okay, I guess one other minor point is when you say man has the freedom to do whatever evil things he chooses. Is that what you said a minute ago?
Yeah.
In other words, a relative that God also has the ability to stop that, because he can change that person's heart at any moment,
sure,
to have him do something different. So in that case, he doesn't really have the freedom he thinks. If God can cause him...
Well, again, you're raising issues that are relevant to God's providence and his causal relationship to the world, and that's not what this is about. This is about merely God's knowing the future. We're studying the doctrine of divine omniscience. And the claim here, on the part of a group of people called open theists, who are evangelicals, but who deny God's foreknowledge of the future. They say God gambles, he doesn't know what's going to happen. And so this is a significant movement that is rending evangelical churches apart. It is a growing movement that we need to be alert to. And it's not about causal determinism or anything. These people believe that if God foreknows things, then everything happens necessarily. And since they think we have freedom, they therefore deny God's foreknowledge, which denies God's omniscience, which denies God's perfection. So this isn't just some academic issue, and I'm not suggesting you're saying it is. I'm just trying to share with the wider group here why we're spending time on this. This is a vitally relevant issue for the church today, that we get straight on our understanding of divine omniscience and foreknowledge. Now, George Weaver last week asked a question, but couldn't we redefine omniscience in such a way that God's ignorance of future free acts doesn't mean he doesn't know everything? What if we define omniscience to mean not that God knows every truth, but that God knows every truth that it's logically possible to know? That he knows everything that it's logically possible to know. It's not logically possible to know the future, free acts of men. And therefore, this is not any infringement upon God's omniscience to be an open theist, because he knows everything that's logically possible for him to know. And that's the way omniscience should be defined. And what I said to George last week was, you can show that even on that, I think, mistaken definition of omniscience, that God still turns out to be not omniscient. And so our second slide that I had made illustrates this point to make it clearer. This is the argument that they give to show that God can't possibly foreknow free acts. Let P be any future tense statement about some action, like George will eat pizza for lunch on Saturday, say. And the argument goes like this: not possibly. God foreknows P, and P is contingently true. To be contingently true is the opposite of being necessarily true. If P is a free act, then it's only contingently true that George eats pizza on Saturday. It's not necessarily true. And so they would say it is not possible that God foreknows P, and P is contingently true. Now, we already saw that that's false, that is theological fatalism, and that there's no good reason to believe that. We've seen that, in fact, that's a fallacy to think that it's not possible for God to foreknow P and for P to be contingently true. But let's give them that premise. Suppose that's the case, that it's not possible for God to foreknow P and P to be contingently true. Secondly, but P is contingently true. George is going to eat pizza for lunch on Saturday. And therefore, they conclude, therefore, it is not possible for God to foreknow P. If it's not possible for God to foreknow P and P be contingently true, and P is contingently true, therefore it's not possible that God foreknows P. And so that's their argument to show that it's not possible for God to foreknow these future contingents, and so that doesn't infringe his omniscience. Problem is, this argument is also logically invalid. That is to say, it breaks the rules of logic. All that follows from the two premises is, therefore, God does not foreknow P, but it doesn't follow that it's impossible for him to know P. He could know P, but in this case, it would just follow that he doesn't. So the argument doesn't show, in fact, that it's not possible for God to foreknow P, and therefore, it would mean that if he doesn't foreknow P, he's not omniscient. Because remember, the revised definition says that to be omniscient, you have to know everything that is logically possible to know, And here we see it's not true that it's logically impossible for God to know P. It is possible for God to know foreknow P. So that is just a little bit more information on George's question that shows that even if you revise the doctrine of omniscience to say, well, God needs to know everything that's logically possible to know, it still turns out that he's not omniscient, because there are things that it's logically possible for him to know, and he doesn't know them. And so he wouldn't be omniscient, even on that revised definition, which is in itself inadequate. Now, I realize that's a little bit complex, but I thought George's question was an important one and needed to be addressed a little more deeply. Any comment or question on that issue? Okay. So, in conclusion to this section, then, on divine foreknowledge and human freedom, I think we can say that there is no good reason to think that in virtue of his knowledge of the future, that everything is fated to occur. God foreknows everything that's going to happen. He foreknows every true proposition, including future tense propositions, and yet that is perfectly compatible with freedom and contingency. Any final comment or question on this section? Yes, right over here. And say your name again, please.
My name is Jim.
Jim, right.
Just because God has foreknowledge, can something not occur?
Well, I would say that not because, but
no,
even though.
With God.
Yeah, even though God has foreknowledge,
something
it could fail to occur. Right. Even though God foreknows X, X could fail to occur. But it won't. That's right. If it were to fail to occur, then he wouldn't know it.
Secondly, is this as simple as a matter of timing? In other words, if I sit here and think about foreknowledge of what you're going to say next, I might put together a pretty good assessment and guess that what words you're going to use.
Right.
But if I truly could see the future, then I would know what words you were going to use.
Yes.
But I wouldn't have affected them.
That's right.
I wouldn't have directed them. I wouldn't have
yeah. That's exactly right. And that's why I say
okay,
fatalism is just unintelligible. How could you just knowing what words I'm going to say when you'd have no effect on them? How could that do anything to constrain what I'm going to say? Fatalism has got to be false because it posits a constraint that just doesn't make any sense. Yes, Steve?
It seems like you could say that just because something God knows it makes it necessarily true, you could also say, but it could be come about for its own reasons, for its own cause, and therefore you don't have to have, it would be true whether it was necessarily true or not. And that's kind of like saying the same thing you're saying now.
And well, I'm not sure I understand you, but what causes the event is just really irrelevant here because we're not talking about causal determinism.
Right.
So
why
the event occurs in terms of its causes just doesn't matter.
So you have an event, and so you have the 3B, the three star that you have down here where, therefore, P will occur.
Yes.
It could, that's true. It could also be necessarily true also. And so
it could be, but not in virtue of God's foreknowledge.
Right.
It doesn't follow from his foreknowledge that it will occur necessarily.
Yeah.
Which is what the fatalist says.
Right. And so what you have so far is that God knows everything.
Yes.
God does not, man still has free will.
Right.
But doesn't the scripture also say that God causes everything?
Well, that's what we're going to talk about when we get to the doctrine of providence. We will talk about that when we get to the doctrine of providence and sovereignty. Here we're just talking about omniscience. All right, any other question on this section? Yes, Bill.
Could you use that in, because when you explain how the Bible was written and how this happened and that, could you take the book of Jonah and say, explain the way you just did, putting that in the writing of the book of Jonah? That God, as Jonah wrote, God foreknew.
Now, are you talking about the prophecy that Jonah gave to Nineveh, 40 days and Nineveh will be overthrown?
No,
are you talking about
occurring,
the book itself?
Right, the book itself. Jonah wrote the book, and
right.
From what you went over when we first started, he wrote it through the events that occurred.
All right, what I would refer you back to here, if I understand your question, Bill, would be the first section of this class on doctrine of revelation, where we looked at the doctrine of inspiration. And remember, I talked about how God knows what every person would freely do in any set of circumstances he was in. So knowing that the prophet or apostle was in a certain set of circumstances, he knew that he would freely write, say, the book of Romans or the book of Jonah. And so you can have a doctrine of inspiration of Scripture that doesn't imply a dictation theory of inspiration. So that material was covered in that section of the class, and I'd encourage you to look on the website, you know, or on the JFBC website for the CDs that were made of that. I think that this is helpful in talking about doctrine of inspiration, yes. Yes, Steve?
With respect to God's foreknowledge of events, are those events considered to be potential events? I'm sure they're not actual events. The reason I'm asking is because of, you know, counting infinite number of events.
Right. Okay. You're drawing in another issue here. Whether or not these future events known by God are actual or not is going to depend on your theory of time. Suppose this is space-time, and time is the dimension vertically on the diagram. This is the Big Bang down here, and this is the Big Crunch up here where the universe recollapses. On a B theory of time, all events in time and space are equally real. So if we're, say, here, the events up here are actual, Steve, on a B theory of time. They are real and actual. But if you're an A theory of time advocate, then you don't think that the future is real. It's merely potential. All that exists is what exists now. And so events in the future that God foreknows will happen don't exist in any sense. They're pure potentiality. And in that sense, you can say that the series of events is potentially infinite. It will go on forever without any end. But the future is not actually infinite because there really aren't any future events. They don't exist at all. So that's going to depend on which theory of time you adopt. Is that clear?
I do understand what you're saying, but I've got a follow-up question then.
All right.
But maybe I'll ask it when you get to your cosmological arguments, because...
Okay, if it is pertinent to that, yeah, let's hang on to it.
I just wanted to... What I was going to say was, you know, those arguments, those philosophical arguments you have in the cosmological argument...
Yes.
...about the impossibility of an actually infinite number of events, couldn't that be used against counting up the future potential events?
Well, I think only if they're real. And I don't think there are an actually infinite number of future events. Indeed, I don't think there are any future events. I think that they don't exist at all. So there aren't any future events. They don't exist. There will be events, but as they occur, they will be potentially infinite. They will go on and on forever. But in fact, there are no future events on the A theory of time. All right, well, let's turn to the next section now, which is the second problem raised by God's omniscience, and that is the question of what I call God's hypothetical knowledge, his hypothetical knowledge. A lot of time people ask the question, why did God create the world if he knew it would be such a mess? Why did he create the world if he knew it was going to be so bad as this? Now, here we need to draw an important distinction in answering this question between God's foreknowledge and what we could call his hypothetical knowledge. God's foreknowledge is his knowledge of everything that will be. He knows what will happen. By contrast, his hypothetical knowledge is his knowledge of everything that would be under certain circumstances. And one of my favorite illustrations of this is the wonderful scene in Dickens' Christmas Carol when Scrooge is confronted with the ghost of Christmas yet to come. And after seeing these horrifying scenes of Tiny Tim's death and then his own death, Scrooge asks the spirit, are these shadows of things that will be or shadows of things that might be only. And the Spirit doesn't answer Scrooge. In fact, Scrooge was asking the wrong question. What the Spirit was showing Scrooge was not shadows of things that will be. He wasn't showing him the actual future. We know from the end of the story that Tiny Tim did not die, that Scrooge reformed his life and learned to celebrate Christmas and keep it in his heart. So these weren't scenes of what will be. But neither was the Spirit showing Scrooge merely scenes of what could be. I mean, anything could happen. What he was showing Scrooge was what would happen if Scrooge were not to repent. He was showing Scrooge hypothetical knowledge of what would be the case if Scrooge were not to repent. And so when the person asks, well, if God knew the world would be such a mess, why did he create it? He's not talking about God's foreknowledge. Because if God knows that this is the way it will be, it's in a sense too late to do anything about that. The future, by definition, is what will be. So if God knows that it will be that way, then that's the way it's going to be. Rather, what a person is really asking is, did God have knowledge of the way the future or the course of events would be if he were to create it so that he could say, oh, that looks like it's going to be bad. I'm not going to do it. I'm going to refrain from creating it. This is this hypothetical knowledge. So what the person is really assuming here is that God had hypothetical knowledge of the way the world would turn out if he were to create it in a certain way. Now, this is, in fact, a controversial issue. Not all theologians agree on this. Some theologians say that God doesn't have this sort of hypothetical knowledge about what would happen if he were to create the world. He has foreknowledge of what will happen, but he doesn't have this sort of hypothetical knowledge. And so if you take that view, that enables you to completely short-circuit this question, because God didn't know how the world would turn out if he were to create it in a certain way, and therefore he can't be held responsible for the way the world turns out and the way he knows that it will be. So if God doesn't have this kind of hypothetical knowledge, he can't be held responsible for such a messed up world existing. On the other hand, I think there are powerful theological reasons for thinking that God does have this sort of divine hypothetical knowledge. Could I have a glass of water or something? My throat's getting a little bit dry. Thank you. I think there are good reasons to think God does have this sort of hypothetical knowledge. The Bible teaches divine sovereignty and providence over everything that happens in the world. On the Christian view, the world is not just some sort of a cosmic accident. Rather, God planned the world down to its most minute detail. Everything that happens in the world happens either by God's direct will or at least by his permission. Everything that happens is either by his will or by his permission. And this kind of providential planning of a world requires hypothetical knowledge on God's part. God would need to know what every free creature would do under any circumstances in which God might create him. So by creating, thank you, certain creatures in certain circumstances, God could bring it about that his ends are achieved through the free decisions of those people. Now, this sort of process would be unimaginably complex when you think about it. Just think what would be involved in bringing about a single event in history, say the Allied victory at D-Day. God would have to have all of the right people in all of the right places to freely make all of the right decisions. And, of course, that would depend upon their parents and their education, their upbringing, and just a myriad of factors that soon becomes incomprehensible to a finite mind. Only an infinite mind could have the grasp of the complexity necessary in order to plan a world of free creatures on the use by using this hypothetical knowledge. And this would solve the dilemma then of divine foreknowledge, of divine sovereignty and human freedom. God is sovereign over the world in that he creates the people he wants in the circumstances he wants, knowing how they would freely choose, so that his ends are ultimately achieved through the free decisions of these creatures. So God is sovereign, and yet people are free. And this sort of hypothetical knowledge has a technical name for it. It's called middle knowledge, because it's in between God's knowledge of everything that could be and his knowledge of everything that will be. It's his knowledge of everything that would be under any particular circumstances. Now, suppose God then does have this kind of middle knowledge or hypothetical knowledge of everything that would happen under any circumstances. How might one answer the question, then, why did God create such a messed up world as the world that we have on our hands? Well, I think the answer might be that God's options may be limited. It may be that his options are limited. That is to say, given that God wanted creatures to be free creatures, it may be that they would have messed up any world that God could have created. In any world of free creatures, it's possible that those creatures would go wrong and introduce sin and corruption into that world. And so in any world that's feasible for God, that has this much good in it, there would also be this much suffering and evil in the world. In every circumstance in which God creates a person, God's will is that that person do the right thing, that he refrain from sin, that he do the morally right thing. But God knows that if he put some people in certain circumstances, they would freely sin. They wouldn't do the right thing. And God then wills to permit that. He doesn't want them to sin, but knowing that's how they would freely choose, he permits them to do so. But in his providence, he so orders the world that on balance, he creates a world in which there is much more good than evil in the world, and which will ultimately result in his final purpose being achieved. Namely, a world in which there is a multitude of persons in heaven from every tribe and tongue and people and nation who come to know him and his salvation. And therefore, we can be confident that God's choice of the world is the wisest choice, that despite the sufferings and the inequities of this life, nevertheless, it is under God's sovereign direction and will be a world in which ultimately multitudes of persons will be saved and come to know him, and that these evils and suffering in the world were permitted only with this good end in mind. What that means, then, is that the onus is really on us. It's we who mess up the world by our own free choices and decisions. It's not God who is to blame for the world being the way it is. Rather, it's us, and that therefore we need to turn to him for forgiveness and moral cleansing for the way in which we've messed up the world in ways that he doesn't want us to do. All right, any question about this aspect of God's hypothetical knowledge? Yes, we have a question right down here in front.
Now, you mentioned that this would be that under that logic, God would have created this world as being his wisest choice in all possible worlds to make, all integrating free will.
Yes, although that doesn't mean that there is a unique wisest choice. There could be a whole range of good choices that he could make.
I just wanted to bring up the example that the whole idea that we are living in the best of all possible worlds,
right,
that Voltaire ruthlessly attacks in his,
yes,
book Candide.
Right. And this isn't committed to that. There are lots of possible worlds that are better than this, but it may be that they're not feasible for God because his options are limited by the free will of creatures. God, I think you could say, maybe a world in which there is a multitude of creatures who all freely never do sin, never do any evil, they all go to heaven, that would be a much better world than this one. But it's not feasible for God to create such a world, because in any world of free creatures that he creates, which has as much good as this one, there would also be this much evil and suffering. So I'm not suggesting that this is the best of all possible worlds by any means. Is that clear? So it's a difference between a possible world and worlds that are feasible for God, given human freedom. Yes?
Yes, Bill, my question kind of segues into that or piggybacks on it. It's my observation that the way the world is to show the maximum, the passion of salvation, for instance. Jesus dying on the cross. Well, Jesus could have been sacrificed in any number of ways, but I believe God chose the absolutely most impactful, dramatic, and all-time, you know, there will be no equal to that. But in the apocryphal book of Esdras, God answers Ezra as to why there are so many sinners and so few saints. And God answers and says, just as there's much clay in the world and so little gold, which is, it reflects on the situation of our world, because God, as the designer, created this world so that the good would be so good and the wicked would be so wicked. Mm-hmm. Anyway, my question would be, how would that relate to the what?
Well, I think one thing that Hobart is raising that is a very profound theological question is the good of Christ's atoning death. Some theologians have thought that the good of Christ's sacrificial death on the cross is a good which is so great that, in fact, a world in which horrible evil and sin exist is, on balance, actually better than a sinless world, because the sinless world would not have this great good of the sacrificial atoning death of Christ. And, as you say, this tremendous, passionate demonstration of the love of God. So that is a very interesting point to say, why think that a world without sin is or evil is necessarily a better world than a world in which there is tremendous sin, wickedness, and evil, but there is also this tremendous and overwhelming great good of the redemption that is in Christ. And I think that's a very profound point to ponder, and it may well be the case that this is a good that is so great that it justifies God creating a world that is horribly messed up, as you say. Okay, well, we're out of time. But next week we'll take any residual questions on this, and then we'll look at some application of God's attribute of omniscience for our personal Christian lives.
The copyright for the content of this recording is held by Dr. William Lane Craig. For more, go to reasonablefaith.org.